Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Gill, Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. Today we live in a world where finding ways to get along with people of different identities, people who have different political ideas, different religious ideas, well, this is a major challenge. We say that we believe in diversity, but sometimes putting that belief into practice can be pretty hard work. In this part of the show, we'll be talking with William Connolly. He is a leading figure in the world of political theory, and we'll be talking about something that he has thought a lot about and written about, and that is pluralism. Talking about how it is that people who have fundamentally different worldviews can still find some way to peacefully live with one another. He's written a book on this subject. It's, I believe, his most recent, and the title of the book is Pluralism, and it is published by the Duke University Press, came out in 2005. If you're interested, you can seek it out. He is professor of political science at Johns Hopkins University and is now spending some time on the campus of the University of Illinois. So we're pleased that he could be here in the studio with us. Questions, comments are welcome. As always, the only thing we ask of people is that they try to be brief, and we just ask that to keep the program moving along and accommodate as many different callers as possible. Anyone is welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
What about pluralism interests you?
I think that many things interest me, but I think that most of our conceptions or ideas about pluralism have not really kept up with what's happening in the world, what's happening in the United States. And so we have to keep rethinking it. Hmm. For example, it seems to me that a lot of people who celebrate pluralism celebrate diversity that is already established. But pluralism involves both established diversities and new diversities that periodically come into being. And that's where the rub often happens with respect to pluralism. So that's one of the things that I wanted to try to think about.
Well, it strikes me that it is an idea that we say that we honor. It's something that we say that we believe in. And perhaps when we say that, we do really mean that. Right. But as I said, it can be very difficult. Once you say, yes, you believe in that, when it really is put to the test, now there we're going to see, well, what exactly is your commitment to the, how much commitment do you have to the idea?
Right. And your point about when we are really put to the test, because when we're put to the test is when something comes along that shocks or disturbs us in a visceral way. We feel it in our gut. It's disturbing to us. And because we're such complex embodied beings, you can't be in the world without having those kinds of body shocks and feelings. And so your initial response to these shocks about something that's new, that's something that's disturbing, that's something that's unexpected and that other people are trying to legitimate, your initial response is probably to say no. And sometimes you're right to say no. So this opens up the question of kind of sensitivity to coming to terms in a more fast-paced world than ever before, coming to terms with new social movements, new processes that are disturbing to you at first. They might threaten your identity at first, and then kind of working on yourself or working and also working on ourselves. So yeah, I like your formulation. Let's put it to the test, because that's what it always is. That's what pluralism always involves is. And those of us who think of ourselves as pluralists, who celebrate pluralism, we are also put to the test. And so we have to remember that we are also put to the test. And it's not terribly surprising that this happens to people, because new things are coming into being.
Well, just maybe we should take a step back here, just in case that there is because there may be somebody who is listening who is saying, well, I'm not exactly sure what it is you mean by pluralism.
Gotcha.
Let's do it. Let's have a basic definition.
Okay. Well, pluralism, as I seek to promote it and to advance it, has a few characteristics. The first one is the appreciation and respect for diversity of multiple types in the same society. So it might include sensual dispositions. It might include religious beliefs. It might include household organization. It might include a variety of things. So I think of pluralism as multidimensional, and classic theories of pluralism usually would focus on one dimension or another. And then the second thing is that pluralism involves coming to terms with new diversities or new identities coming into being or pushing from a threshold below the legitimacy onto the threshold of legitimacy. And then the third thing is I'm a proponent of what I call deep pluralism. That is, that there's no kind of overarching set of faiths or fundamental beliefs or philosophical principles that all of us are going to share. And so we have to come to terms with how people, including ourselves, bring different kind of fundamental orientations into the public realm with them. The old secular idea was that you kept those things in the private realm and you brought just a set of procedures or principles and or reason with you into the public realm. But that has broken down. And so those are some of the characteristics. I shouldn't say too much, but those are some of the characteristics that seem to me to be appropriate to a contemporary experience of pluralism.
Do you think that it is more difficult now to truly embrace pluralism, deep pluralism, than it would have been, I don't know, 100 years ago?
Yeah. I think it cuts in two directions. I think that one of the things that that kind of increases the difficulty for some people is for many people perhaps, is an expectation of a certain kind of consensual foundations that everyone shares, because that is part of the image of the past that they have and that they bring forward. And so that makes it more difficult. But I think that some things make it relatively more easy, especially for children who are growing up in more multicultural settings, and it forms the backdrop, the everyday backdrop of their existence, and especially things like the rapid forms of communication that we have now that make it possible for us to assimilate and digest changes at a somewhat faster pace than heretofore. Mm-hmm. So I really think it cuts in two directions, and I don't know which of the cuts is deeper, and it might vary from issue to issue.
So do you think it is that we tend to overestimate the amount of unity that we might have had in the past? That is, we might have said, well, okay, yes, in the past that there were different people, different ideas about politics, different ideas about religion, but we were okay with that.
Yeah.
That we have forgotten indeed how much conflict there might have been around issues like that, let us just say in the history of the United States.
Right.
And that when we say, well, now there's so much churning, there's so much conflict among people with different values, different ways of living, different religious ideas, that we have forgotten the fact that may in fact be the way that it is now, but 100 years ago it was that way, and 200 years ago it was that way, and so it's not really new.
Yeah, well, absolutely. It's not brand new. Some of the particular issues might change, and one of the things about memory of the past is that it almost necessarily involves simplification, because the brain is not all that huge and all that can have all that complexity in it, especially in kind of our everyday memories involved in action. And so we do simplify the past, and things were more complex and more conflicted then. For just to take one example, I don't know how many people actually know that Thomas Jefferson retranslated the Gospels and thought of Jesus as a noble man, but not a divine being. And so if you look at several of the founding fathers, I'm using these finger quotes that nobody can see, of course, but if you look at the thought of several of the founding fathers who were supposed to have brought a certain kind of uniform Christianity in terms of retrospective views anyhow to America, it turns out that there was remarkable diversity amongst them, and that Jefferson had this interesting offbeat view. It was enough out of touch with the times that he didn't have the book published until after his death, but it was enough in the times that many other people talked with him about it, shared some of those judgments with it, and so forth. So I agree with you that our images of the past are simplified, and especially our that in, with respect to that and with respect to the relationships between American public culture and Amerindian cultures in the early going.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is William Connolly. He is Krieger Eisenhower Professor of Political Science at the Johns Hopkins University and has written about many things, pluralism just being one of them, and is the author of a book on that subject. It was published in 2005. He is here visiting the campus and is talking with us, and questions are welcome. We always like to involve people in the conversation. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. I'm sure that if we ask people to talk about pluralism or say, well, what is it that we really mean, we might get people saying something like, well, it's the idea that all ideas, in a sense, have equal weight, equal value. If, for example, we're talking about religion, pluralism, religion, it says that I have mine, you have yours, and that it's okay, that we can live side by side and honor each other's faith and say that each of them has something to say or something to contribute to the world. At the same time, I'm sure there'd be some people who would be at pains to say that, well, one thing you have to keep in mind when you're talking about pluralism is that pluralism is not relativism. So here now, this gets to the difficult point. Now, if you're truly going to be pluralist, how do you do that if you truly believe whatever you believe, and if you believe in the rightness of your belief? Can you actually be pluralist, because what that does is that it admits that, well, you might actually be wrong. Even admitting that somebody else might be equally right, that could be very difficult.
Well, you put your finger on the nub of the issue, and the issue that keeps coming back and keeps making it the case that we have to periodically recraft our orientations to pluralism, because pluralism is not a society without limits, and it has to have limits. First of all, you can't enclose everything that's possible in any particular way of life. But secondly, the pluralists who are adamantly or actively committed to pluralism have to come up with ways to set limits to unitarian drives in the culture, to set limits to constituencies who think that the faith or principle that they themselves occupy must become the universal faith or the official faith of the entire country. So pluralism always has a set of limits attached to it. Now, some of those limits become renegotiable over time, because there were limits at one time in which you had to be a gentleman and a male in order to participate in voting. That seemed like an ironclad limit to a culture of civilization. But of course, that has broken down. It broke down after very intensive struggles, and so then the pluralism became more intensive. Most people who think of relativism, when you think of relativism, you're thinking about implicitly assuming a culture that has a unitary shape to it, and then, well, they do it this way in that culture, they do it this way in that culture, and so it's relative from culture to culture. But there are no places like that anymore, if there ever were. Most places have diversities of multiple sorts struggling to find a place or actively find a place in them. And so the question is, what kind of ethos of engagement you evolve, you negotiate to establish relationships between diverse constituencies that are already there and some that are coming into being? And I have views about that. There are other people have them as well, but what I should say now that's the difficult dimension in the negotiation of a pluralist culture. A pluralist culture is not an easy place to be. It's not easy going. the way that that nationalists and Unitarians oftentimes think, or they say it's kind of, they think, well, this is the world of self-indulgence. You have to have a lot of civic virtues to participate in a pluralist culture. Yeah.
And when you say Unitarian, you're not talking about with a capital U like the church. You're talking about
as
in
church.
as in everyone believes the same thing.
Yes.
Whatever that is we're talking about.
Exactly.
Well, what is it that you think really makes, to the extent that pluralist societies can actually work, and you can put that value into practice and perhaps struggle with it, but and do it imperfectly. Well, what is it, do you think, that makes pluralist societies work, or why is it that sometimes that breaks down and you end up with those that are small u Unitarian?
Right. Well, I don't have a I wouldn't try to advance a general theory about that and try to look at it in specific cases. For example, with the kind of the enhanced global dimension of capital, one of the things, capital doesn't just homogenize the world. One of the things it does is it helps to minoritize the world. It brings more and more people of different orientations and dispositions into the same territorial place because of labor migration, because of manager migration, because of capital migration, because of the extended communication systems and so forth. So in the world today, a lot of people who are kind of the most adamant defenders of capitalism sometimes are wary or critical or even worse about the minoritization of the world that capitalism is trying to produce. So when I'm arguing with them, I'm saying, well, you're defending capital in this way, you're defending capital in that way. What about this effect of capitalism? And how does it and what are you going to do about that? Are you going to both be a defender of capitalism and a critic of the minoritization of the world that it has fostered more actively, more rapidly, and more diversely than any mode of economic life before it? So, and then in terms of your point about whether it can actually work, I think the issue is really fundamental here. Because we've had, and we will continue to have, this minoritization of the world, you either have to make pluralism work, or you're going to build more repression, more violence, and more intensive discipline into the world that is already there. It becomes a kind of an existential need under late modern life. That's the way I see it.
Hmm. Well, I think one of the things that would be argued really needs to happen actually for pluralism to work is, and perhaps this goes back and touches on the point that pluralism is not relativism, is that people actually, it's a good thing, maybe it's an essential thing for people to actually get together and argue.
Yeah.
Argue in a constructive sort of a way, argue about what they believe. That is, that people who believe different things really do need to sit down and talk and wrestle with what they believe, maybe what they have in common, maybe what divides them, that it can't just be, well, you're going to kind of stay over there in your place and you believe what you believe and I'll stay over here in my place and believe what I believe. That there actually has to be some engagement among different people who believe differently, which again can be really, wars start that way. This can be something that's actually very difficult. Do you think, though, that that's actually something that's important for that to happen?
Right. I mean, you say it very well. I think it's absolutely critical. Like one model of pluralism would be kind of like an enclave model of multiculturalism, where each enclave tries to be in its own part, but their own place and so forth. But that doesn't work. There are too many points of intersection, too many points of inter-involvement, interdependency in a tightly coiled world that we have. And these explorations back and forth, it are absolutely essential, because I can't really come to see how some elements of my most fundamental faith appear contestable from other points of view, from other experiences, until I engage those experiences with other people. And then the next thing that I have to teach myself is to not be too profoundly resentful of the fact that some of my most basic views are contestable from other points of view, and that I may lack kind of definitive ironclad arguments by which I can prove that, you know what, my faith is the universal faith and yours isn't. So that's why I like this idea of bicameral citizenship, where you bring your faith or principles with you into the public realm, and then you recoil back through these explorations and discussions and arguments and debates with others without too much resentment about how contestable some of those things are in the from the point of view and experiences of others. And now you've set, that's bicameral, the two-stage process, that now you set the stage for the negotiation of a positive pluralist ethos of engagement. And that's work, but it can't be so impossible, because millions and millions of people do it all the time. And in fact, the virulent opposition that we see in some circles today to pluralism is a manifestation of the fact that the advances in this ethos of engagement have been great. That's why the opposition is so extreme. They're trying to stop something that is well underway. And so I say it's difficult, but it's not impossible, and a lot of people do it.
It's something that I'm interested in having you talk a little bit about. You just touch on it sort of glancingly in the book and mention the fact that you've written about it elsewhere. But I think that it's an important point, and that can a society truly say that it is pluralist if there is deep and persistent inequality in that society? Can that be? And I think the argument you make is no. In fact, that those two things, pluralism, equality, are necessarily linked. And in fact, that if you progress in what, I think you said something like progress in one area leads to progress in the other.
Yeah. Well, yes, in this book, I kind of enunciate this idea that, contrary to what some theorists and some people say, inequality and pluralism are not adamantly opposed to each other. They're kind of intricated with each other, and so you get this storyline that unless we have a united nation, a unified nation of along the same, we can't reduce inequality, and. I think that means that you'll never get to inequality if that's the idea that you're pursuing. So inequality and pluralism, the same kind of ethos that promotes pluralism, is also well suited to help reduce the most severe inequalities in the world. So I think they are interdependent, inter-involved with each other. And you're absolutely right that in this book, I kind of enunciate that faith, and I don't discuss it in detail, and that's what I'm trying to do now in this next book on called Capitalism and Christianity, American Style. I'm trying to think about what an eco-egalitarian capitalism could look like, and so I'm trying to pick up another piece in the exploration of pluralism, a piece that is not pursued in that book.
Now, you realize, of course, that some people would say you put together capitalism, ecological thinking, and egalitarianism. They'd say, oh, I'm sorry. No, can't do that. That the problem there is capitalism. It runs counter. It almost makes it impossible. It almost makes it impossible to achieve those other kind of goals. That it just does. That you need some other kind of economic philosophy, because capitalism just won't do it.
Yeah. Well, that's the. There's a point at which I agree with them. What I would want to see is what kind of over a 20-year period, In what ways could a capitalist economy be stretched and strained so that it became more ecological and more egalitarian than it is now? And there are all kinds of micro-experiments around in capitalist settings. For example, experiments of the Mondragon activities in Spain, where there are capitalists where the differential is 9-1 in terms of income, as opposed to 435-1 in the United States. And then the Danish economy, which is much more egalitarian in the United States, but it is a capitalist economy. And I think that when people are advancing this notion, which is a notion that I don't dismiss out of hand, and so I'm just playing out a wager here. But when people introduce this notion, they have a kind of a model of pure capitalism. And I would try to suggest that there has never been pure capitalism anywhere. Capitalism is always imbricated with religion. It's always involved with the state. It's always involved with the nature of the educational system, the nature of the resource bases, and science. And so all of these things make a difference to the internal character of capital processes. But I'll concede this. I mean, more than concede it. Capitalism makes the pursuit of eco-egalitarian objectives difficult.
Mm-hmm.
But we have to do that today. We have to come to terms with these issues in the next 20 years, or capitalism itself will be defeated. Now, once we come to terms with them, if you come to terms with them, you might kind of be on the edge of another kind of economic system, but I don't know what it would be yet. And I don't want to say that that it will necessarily go in that direction. Mm-hmm. I just want to say, set a vision for 20 years, come up with actual specific kinds of things that could be done, that might be done through politics and experimentalization, and see, because I agree that to have pluralism, you need to reduce inequality, mm-hmm. and to have both, you got to have to deal with the ecological.
It strikes me that one of the things that in this country we've really never been very good at is balancing the individual good and the public good, and that perhaps for a long time it really didn't matter. We could indulge the individual, but that we've got to the point where we just can't do that anymore. And yet, our belief in the individual, in individualism, in individual rights, is so strong that you can't even get people to think about the idea of public good.
Right. But people do think about it when it comes to a question of war, or it comes to the question of religious orientations, or when it comes to several other kinds of questions. That is, those are constraining conditions that they acknowledge. And so it might be that we will find that we have to recognize the ecological constraints and conditions as actively as we have paid attention to the issues of war and so forth, because the relationship between the individual good and public good is always a tense relationship, and only if you believe in some kind of pure market self-regulation, which I don't believe in, would you kind of think, well, they mesh together perfectly. The individual, what the individual is trying to do always works out eventually for the public good. I don't believe that at all. And I think that the whole question of individualism needs to be kind of up for intense discussion, because there are theories of individualism where you kind of have everybody as the same kind of regular individual, and they all participate in the same kind of market and so forth. Or there are theories of individualism which are really about individuality, that is, about diversities. And I'm an advocate of the second kind, theories of individuality.
We're a little bit past the midpoint here. We're talking with William Connolly. He is Krieger Eisenhower Professor of Political Science at the Johns Hopkins University, someone who is very well known as a leading figure in the world of political theory, and he has written about many different things. This particular subject that we have chosen to talk about, pluralism, just being one of them. Let me mention again his recent book, That's the title, Pluralism. It's published by the Duke University Press. It was published in 2005. He is spending a couple of weeks here on the campus of the University of Illinois as a distinguished Mellon Fellow, and we're really pleased to have him here on the program to talk. Questions, comments are welcome. Anybody can be involved in the conversation. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. It seems that right now in America we're at one of those points, and there certainly have been, it has happened at various times along American history, where we are really concerned about the other and about American identity, and immigration now is an enormous issue. How do you think about, again, our commitment to the idea of pluralism and being a welcoming country and having a place for everybody and acknowledging the fact that it's a country of immigrants and people have come from different places to make this thing that we call America, setting that up against what is our enthusiasm, it would seem, for assimilation, mm-hmm. and the idea that, yes, we believe in that idea of multiculturalism, but only to a certain point. Mm-hmm. And it seems that there are a lot of people now who are very fearful about the other, about newcomers, mm-hmm. and about what that means to the idea of America. And now I'm doing the quotes in the air, the idea of America and what exactly that means.
Right. Well, the question of borders and immigration, that is the question that has to, you have to keep coming back to and thinking and rethinking. My most general view on this is that when you think about the kind of the double take where various business enterprises demand and pull in and siphon in very poor workers and so forth, that helps me to think about the need for more a floor to the income levels in the United States, but it also makes me think about the need for kind of creative work between labor, the state, and business with respect to economic adventures or economic inventions. Organizations on both sides of the Mexican-American border. That is what has to be done to kind of make immigration a viable and manageable process. So you are welcoming, and then when you have immigrants, they don't assimilate. The Protestants expected the Southern European Catholics to assimilate, but they didn't. They became Catholics, and so Protestantism found itself expanding its ranges of tolerance for religious diversity. So the idea of assimilation has to be replaced by the idea or by the themes of an ethos of engagement with each wave, each new wave of immigration that comes in, and people who are more creative than I need to focus on what to do about working on both sides of the border in terms of economic development, so that the pressures are not so extreme. Building fences is not going to do it. Everybody who I know who looks into it says that's not a viable way. It's certainly not not an excellent symbol for the country in which we live.
We have some callers to bring into the conversation. Let's do that. And we'll start with someone in Champaign on our line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
Question. When you say that people didn't assimilate into the immigrants didn't assimilate, well, I disagree. They all assimilated. They learned how to speak English, for one. Can you comment on that? I mean, what do you mean by assimilate?
Well, sure.
The Germans, the Italians, the Irish, everyone, Czechs, whatever language, wherever they came from, they learned to speak English when they came here. So that's assimilating.
Yeah.
Granted, they kept their religions. That's different. Now, the next thing I have to say, what do you mean by capitalism creates minoritization? I don't even think that's a word. What does minoritization What does that mean?
All right. Well,
that's not a word.
Well, thanks. Thanks for your
if
question.
If you can do that within less than 1,000 words, I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, I can do it pretty quickly, I think. But the religious diversity is real. It's not something that is minor. And the fact that with these different waves of immigration, we've extended the number and types of religions that are appreciated and legitimate in the same country, and very significantly so, is extremely important. Think about the orientation to Jews before World War II and the orientation that emerged after World War II. Very dramatic set of differences. The second thing is that, of course, a lot of people who come to immigrate to a new country find that their children become bilingual. What a wonderful thing. I love that, because in the world in which, and I'll use this word again, I'm sure sorry you don't like it, but in this world in which we are witnessing the minoritization, that is, of the world, a world in which more and more minorities find themselves operating on more and more territorial spaces, the bilingualism for the next generation is going to be a very important thing. And so what is called assimilation can be a very flexible idea, or it can be a very rigid idea. I think that assimilation is very, very much a two-way street, and it has been. And I think that's one of the memories of assimilation carry with them these kinds of these kinds of simplifications about what actually was going on. Flint, Michigan, my girlfriend when I was 16 years old was Italian. Her parents mostly spoke Italian. She was bilingual. She's still bilingual. I wish I spoke Italian.
Let's go on. Urbana, line two. Hello.
Hi. One of the things that I've noticed more so recently, it seems to me, with the rise of evangelicalism in the U.S., is this notion that anybody else is godless. If you're not born again, and especially if you're an atheist or a Muslim, you're godless. And it's not so much fear as you're going to go to hell, and it's your choice, and you're an evil person. I even had somebody say to me that since I wasn't of his religion, that I was immoral. I was just astounded. That's a whole additional thing in addition to this other person being strange or different. It's you're an immoral person because you don't share my beliefs, which adds a whole other layer to this. I don't know how many people who are Muslims feel that way. It would seem that some do, the ones who are blowing other people up, but I don't think that most Muslims feel that way. It used to be, as I understand it, that in primitive, much earlier times, when people, the word for themselves was their word for people, and anybody else was non-people.
Yeah.
So I sort of have a feeling that we're doing that now, with different terms. If you don't share my religious beliefs, and if I feel that if you don't, you're eternally damned, so you must be an immoral person. That's a whole other layer to stuff. And I'm also concerned because we have some religious groups who feel that because they feel they hold a monopoly on morality, that they can ignore anybody else's strongly held beliefs and establish and influence government policy. Reproductive rights is one thing, for instance, and George Bush has appointed somebody to be in charge of the Federal Family Planning Program who does not believe in family planning. Those are examples. And when we have the current Pope, when he was in his previous office, wrote I don't know what the official term is for it, but there was something, a pronouncement that the previous pope gave out, which was that Catholicism was superior to everything else and any other religion was deficient. I found that to be really, really off-putting. Comments from you?
Well, yeah, well, sure. I mean, I appreciate the things that you're saying. Let's start with the rise of the evangelical movement in the United States today. It's a it became energized in the 70s. You know, as late as the middle 1970s, Jerry Falwell thought that the evangelical movement should stay out of politics, that it would be corrupted if it stayed in, got in politics, and so there was a very active campaign from several sectors to bring the evangelical movement into kind of line with what I'm calling a kind of the cowboy version of capitalism, and it did become very intense. The first thing that we maybe want to keep in mind, though, is that there are growing fissures and cracks and diversities within the evangelical movement. And those of us who hold your view and my view, your views and my views, might be a good idea for us to become highly aware of them, alert to them, and even engaging with these evangelicals across a certain kind of difference in our underlying beliefs. So, for example, there is a movement within evangelism today called open theism, where the idea is that when you look at Scripture closely, God learns as the world moves, and that makes contact with a lot of other kinds of perspectives. And one of the leading lights of this is John Sanders, an evangelical preacher, who he was brought before the evangelical leaders, but he wasn't circumcised and he wasn't rendered heretical, and so this is a kind of an opening by a minority within the evangelical movement, and I want to pay a lot of attention to those as they develop. So I don't think of it. So I won't have the view of kind of thinking of it as a block or a fixed block and so forth. And then there is the most virulent edge of it, in which anyone else who doesn't have my exact belief is godless. It's the funny thing is, in the history of kind of religions, the tendency is to call on the virulent edge of every faith, the most virulent edge is to call anybody who doesn't have your belief an atheist. The question is how to stop or limit the successes of this constituency in imposing its what I've called Unitarian image of society upon us, to set limits to what they can do, and that's why pluralists have to be militant sometimes. In the interests of protecting diversity, we have to become militant sometimes. So you both try to set limits, and then you try to open doors to these minority expressions that are sometimes surprising once you start looking into them. But thanks for all of your comments. I agree with almost everything that you're saying.
All right, let's go to line number three. This is another call. This is Champagne. Hello.
Hello. This picks up right on what you were just talking about. You did mention a movement or a strain in theological thought of open theism, but I'm wondering if you're following also some emerging movements like the Network for Spiritual Progressives, which was, I believe, founded by Rabbi Michael Lerner, and also Sojourners, which is sort of being spearheaded now by Jim Wallace. So, for example, Wallace has, I believe he identifies himself as a progressive or liberal evangelical, and he's been saying in speeches as he's traveling around to promote one of his books, he's saying that we are now seeing the end of the monologue of the religious right. And he's been meeting, for example, with Democrats to, the way it's sort of framed in the media is to kind of teach Democrats how to discuss, for example, the budget in terms of moral values, right? So there are sort of these new movements to open the dialogue more and sort of reframe our understanding of what religious identity is And I'm wondering if you're watching those movements in particular, and what sort of success you think they might have. And I guess my other question would be, you know, it part of what they're struggling with is a kind of issue of communication ethics, right? I mean, people will say, it's nice that you're talking to the Democrats to have them include religious rhetoric, but you don't want them to do that if it's not authentic, right? You don't want to just exploit religion instrumentally, because then you'd just be reproducing the same problem that some people are criticizing the religious right for doing. So I guess I'll just leave it at that and see what you think about those questions.
Yeah, well, thanks. I am aware of Michael Lerner's effort and definitely of Jim Wallace's effort. And those are kinds of cracks and openings that are very, very, not only very welcome, but could have important implications as kind of pluralizing movements within these, in Wallace's case, the evangelical tradition, but also in Lerner's case, kind of this pursuit of an ethos of engagement across religious traditions. There are other people as well. Cornel West, in some of his work, thinks about and pursues this issue, and of course, Jimmy Carter does. So we know now, but I haven't actually myself explored this enough, though I'm going to have to. We know that there's a burgeoning kind of an environmental movement within evangelism today, those debates and disputes within are going to kind of ramify out in terms of the debates between us, in terms of the question about the communicative ethics. One of the things that strikes me is important is that when people who have traditionally kind of defined themselves, let's say, as secularists, speak, maybe it's important for those of us, I try to do it now, to talk about the spirituality which inspires them so that they don't act like they're just kind of analysts, so they don't act like they're just above the fray, bringing kind of abstract principles to bear on the situation. So you put yourself in the fray. You render yourself vulnerable in that way. And I think that might be part of the communicative ethics that you are that you're pursuing. So those are some thoughts about the really important point that you're making about people who call themselves spiritual progressives and others.
Let's get one more caller here in Farina, line number 4. Hello.
Hi. I want to compliment the host for the variety of topics on this on these programs. It's just astounding, and you're just such a knowledgeable host. And you just mentioned this thing. I'd like to hear a quick definition of secular humanist that I've heard vilified. Okay, that's all. Thanks.
All right. Well, we could probably spend some time talking about that. How do you define? Are you a secular? Do you consider yourself to be a secular humanist?
I'm not opposed to secular humanists, but I think that the very idea of secularism is one that hasn't been able to sustain itself, and it has led to a certain kind, a certain tendency within secularism itself, in some circles of secularism, to a kind of a dogmatism. And so I am myself a non-theist, and I bring a non-theistic spirituality into the world, and I find myself engaging a variety of traditions that some secularists that I've known, and I used to be a secularist, but some secularists I know think should be just left in the private realm. But I think that this private public split between faith and public discourse hasn't really been sustained in the past and is not likely to be sustained in the future. I would never heap contempt on what you're calling secular humanists, but I would try to argue with them a bit. I would try to argue that those people who have been on our side also have some things to learn about the role of theistic or non-theistic faith in their own thinking, judgment, the principles that they adopt, the priorities that they bring with them into public life, and that the modest contribution that secular intellectuals made to the burgeoning of an evangelical fundamentalism is that sometimes there was a tendency to act as if we have the principles and our principles are neutral with respect to different religious faiths. And people from a lot of other backgrounds said, listened to what was said, listened to the things, and said, no, you guys have partialities too. So I think that it's very important for those who have kind of thought of themselves as secularists to take another look at themselves. And that's what I mean by this bicameral or this kind of double orientation to your own basic views.
Hmm. There was so much more that we could discuss. We have another caller here, but I'm afraid that we are just going to have to stop right for the moment because we are indeed up to the end of the time. If people who are listening would like to think more about, read more about the subject of pluralism and our guest and some of his ideas on this subject, well, you go out and look for this book that I've mentioned once or twice. Pluralism is the topic of the book. Duke University Press, the publisher. It came out in 2005. Our guest, William McConnelly, is professor of political science at the Johns Hopkins University, and he is spending now a couple of weeks here on the campus of the University of Illinois. Thanks very much for stopping by.
Thanks so much for having me. The questions were really challenging.